This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to another episode of the New Books Network. My name is Jolie Ho, and you are listening to the Psychology Channel. I'm very excited to introduce Dr. Batya Mesquita to discuss her latest book, Between Us, How Cultures Create Emotions. Dr. Mesquita is a social psychologist and affective scientist. She is a distinguished professor of psychology at the University of Leuven in Belgium, as well as the director of the Center for Social and Cultural Psychology in Leuven as well. Dr. Mesquita also completed postdoctoral work at the University of Michigan in the United States, where she was part of the research group on culture and cognition that has played a key role in the start of further research on cultural psychology. In Dr. Mesquita's book, she asks us to reconsider our emotions through the lens of culture and relationships. By showcasing both rigorous research studies and different personal stories, she takes a deep dive into how culture shapes how we experience emotions. Batya, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for that wonderful introduction, Jolie.
As someone who has lived across various cultures and often reflects on the differences between them, I was really intrigued and drawn to the premise of your book and really excited to read more about it. And I was wondering what inspired you to write this book?
It's hard to sum that up in one sentence, but I think what really inspired me is at the time I was living in Amsterdam, and I lived with a lot of different cultures that were a lot of immigrant cultures. And there seemed to be some differences in emotions, but yet the psychology that we had at that point was in the 80s, all pointed to similarities. And so my first question was really, and that was the question of me and my advisor at the time, Nico Freida, was, is there anything about emotions that is different? And so it was a very theoretical question. And how can we explain that emotions look so different if, you know, all we know from psychology is that they're universal, basically?
Yeah, and that actually lends really well to what I was wondering about and what you explain in the beginning of the book. Is you describe in the early chapters some of the earlier work on emotions where, like you said, a lot of it was based on similarities or geared towards this idea of emotions being hardwired or universal. And you also mentioned some famous work by Paul Ekman and colleagues and other researchers at the time. And this seems to be the general assumption that a lot of people have emotions, that they're universal, and also that at their core, experienced in the same way by all of us. And I'm wondering if you could tell us a bit more about why this may not be the case.
Yeah, I mean, the real question would be, why would it be the case? What evidence do we have that it is the case? But I think why it would not be the case, I mean, there are many reasons to think it's not the case. One of them is that we actually, when we looked at, let me precede that by saying that I think, you know, that Paul Ekman should be credited, was one of the people to be credited with making the topic of emotions researchable. So when I'm saying what I do not like about the research or why I don't think the research is conclusive, I'm standing on a giant's shoulders, right? It's not at all meant to be respectless. But, you know, in hindsight and 50 years later, I think we can say that what he did was, what he and his colleagues did was show pictures of still faces, have people pair them with a list of emotion words, and infer from the fact that they chose the emotion word from the list of six that was, you know, most likely, inferred from the fact that they did that above chance, that there were universal emotions. And, you know, I just don't think that, it's not just me, but I don't think that conclusion is warranted. One of the reasons, there's a lot of work initiated by Jim Russell, I think, where you see that the less cues you give people for the answers, the more variation there is in how people perceive those faces. So that's for starters. It also seems that the words themselves present a certain context. So people look at the face and, you know, they know that you as a researcher want them to choose an emotion word. If you ask them without any context, they can also say that this person wants to yell at you, or this person is not going to be happy, or this person is going to leave everything as it is. So one of the, Jim Russell and Fernandez, Miguel Fernandez Dolls have done these, have made this really nice chapter where they say, you know, obviously, people recognize something in those faces. It's not that they're arbitrary configurations, but it's not at all clear that what they recognize is actually an emotion. And, you know, to link it to the cultural work, I think nobody really asked. So people translated the words. So anger would be in my culture would be Bosheit. These are the two languages that I know the best. But nobody actually did the work of, were those two words referring to the same phenomena? So, you know, literally, we didn't know. We knew that people connected the same pictures with maybe the translations of the words, but we didn't know to what extent those words translated. So I think there's a lot of reasons to think that what those initial experiments did was not to prove that there were universal emotions. Now, of course, it's not just the face research, but let me turn it around and say, what is it that we really talk about when we talk about emotions? And we usually do not talk about, you know, the Western idea in any case is that if you could see through the skull, that the emotions would be there, firing or not firing, but they would be there. And they would always be the same. They would maybe be just elicited and firing or not, you know, or not elicited. But that's a little bit like the movie Inside Out, where those little figurines live. But we don't have any evidence that that's the case. And what in fact, when you look at what people refer to when they refer to episodes of anger, is really an event, an initial response by somebody, usually another person or other people responding to that initial response. And so emotion, what we talk about when we talk about emotions is usually an episode, a social episode, an interaction. Now, once you see it that way, the question is really, why would that be similar across cultures? Because not the same situations happen, not the same initial responses happen. when those same initial responses happen, they don't have the same meaning in different cultures. So other people respond differently to them. So the course of the episode is going to be different. And so what we talk about when we talk about what you can compare emotion words with or emotion labels or concepts with is probably best compared with something. And, you know, my somebody in my lab, Katie Hooman and her colleagues did the work that probably you talk about something like an abstract concept. So an emotion is like a word like justice. We have an idea of what it entails, but the meaning of justice is inferred from the many episodes that we have called just. And so in the same way, I and others would say, what you mean when you say this person is angry or there is anger in this situation is really referring to a category of all the instances, of all the interactions that you would call anger. And we know that the cause of anger and the meaning of anger is different across cultures. Now, just to go one step back to the facial research, we did some research. I mean, people have varied on the paradigm, but I think it's worth noting that even the paradigm of showing a single face without a context, with no other people around, is already a choice of what you look at. And so what I try to say in the book is it's not a coincidental choice. It's actually a choice that coincides with how psychologists and many people in the West conceptualize emotions, namely as something that's going on within a culture. When we show in research with Taka Masuda and Phoebe Ellsworth and others, when we show Japanese people a face in the context of other faces that also have emotions, then Japanese determine the emotion of that middle face by also looking at the other faces. So what you can say, actually, if you do the same experiment, if you do it in America, then people, regardless of whether there are other faces, they look at the central face and say this what this person is feeling. So it seems that the whole paradigm that Ekman started from is a paradigm that that models the way that Western people, or at least American students, perceive emotions more than it models the way that people in many other contexts infer emotions. It's even more complicated, even with Western people, when you also show context, and sometimes the information of the context trumps the information of the face. So it's more, we are much more nuanced in our knowledge anyway. But also as a cultural paradigm, and I'm mentioning it because I think it's important that, of course, in part, what you find is how you design the experiment. And much of what we have done in psychology, I think generally, but certainly in emotion psychology, has started from an idea, but probably also the practice of how we do emotions in the West. And so part of our findings can be explained by having brought people into a situation that simulated the way, you know, people experience it in the West, by yourself, individuals, separated. So I can say more about that, but I'll leave it at that for now.
Yeah, thanks for that. There's so much there in what you just said. And I think just going off of your last point, like that's not even something I'd really thought about in those initial facial experiments, how even the design of those experiments come from maybe a certain cultural lens or perspective where you would be zoning in on someone's singular face and maybe trying to determine what that particular person is feeling. And it is quite decontextualized, at least in those earlier studies there. So that's really fascinating to hear more about that history and yeah,
it's
where
really
design come from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really decontextualized. And if I can add one more thing, is what we ask people there is to make a mental inference, right? We ask them, I mean, we basically say you need to know from how they look what they feel. And even mental inferences are more likely to be made in some cultures than in other cultures. So whether you describe behavior or interpret behavior as a sign of what's going on in the mind or within a person or describing it in terms of a mental state is very different across cultures. So in more than one way, this paradigm was really modeled by what we know in Western cultures. You make a mental inference on the basis of one person's behavior. So in many ways, I think this, you know, this simulated the Western perception of emotion model.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and from there we begin to move into, okay, then what is maybe one way that we can conceptualize these emotions in this cultural context, in this social context? And in your book, you introduced two different acronyms to describe these different ways of thinking about emotions. And just to briefly let our listeners know, so one of these acronyms that you included in your book is that of mine emotions. So MINE, where that stands for emotions being mental, inside the person, and essentialist. And that is contrasted against ours emotions, so OURS, where emotions are outside the person, relational, and situated. And I know you started to touch on this a little bit, but I'm wondering if you could share with our listeners what the key differences are between mine and ours emotions and how you were led to this way of conceptualizing emotions between cultures.
Yeah, for this sophisticated audience, I would say that there aren't ours and mine emotions, but there are ours and mine models to describe emotions. So that they're really, again, we don't want to essentialize those, but they're lenses through which we can look at emotion. And what I would say is that even in cultures where where the mind model is foregrounded, we do have something like ours. But I think that the model that we talked about, that emotions are primarily an experience within the person, and that they're always the same. Now, I don't know if the essentialist, if they're always the same, if you can even say that for Western cultures, because I don't think anger, I really don't think that anger at the state of the world is the same as anger at my child's bad behavior, or is the same as anger at my partner who is, you know, not giving me enough attention. So I don't think that that anybody would say that anger in each of those moments is the same. But the other aspects of emotions, I think it's a matter of emphasizing. So I do think that emotions are, in most cultures, have a mental state attached to it. But there are cultures where that is the definition of an emotion, that you have that mental state. And in some cultures, it can co-occur, but the emotion is really not defined by the mental state, but it's more defined by what's happening in the environment, what the behavior is, and what the event was. So outside and inside the person, I think inside is an emphasis on mental states. Outside is an emphasis on what emotions do between people. And so you could say, being angry is mostly letting you know that I'm not accepting your behavior. Now, arguably, that's also what people who are focused on the mental feeling do. And there is some research by, for example, Gerben van Kleef and his colleagues, where he shows that anger has this, that other people read anger as having exactly this relational message. Namely, this person is not going to accept it. And he looks in the context of business negotiations and sees that if a business partner is angry, that people do make more concessions in the deal because they think this person is not going to accept it. To the contrary, when people are happy, People make fewer concessions than if there was no emotion because they think, oh, this person likes it the way it is, so we don't need to make any concessions. So I would argue that even in cultures that focus on the mental feeling as a defining feature of emotions, it's not unimportant what emotions do between people. And so in that sense, it's a model more than really, it's different. It's a different highlights more than that. The phenomenon itself is different. Having said that, it actually makes a big difference in a lot of emotional processes, how you think about it. And one example is that if you think that emotions are situated, so meaning that an emotion is always mostly shaped by the situation in which it occurs, or saying it another way, that we need to feel the way that is expected by, you know, the role that we have in this society, the expectations of other people, that our emotions should be dictated by the circumstances or the norms that prevail for those circumstances. People who grow up in a culture that thinks about emotions that way also manage their emotions differently. And so there are different studies showing that when you assume that emotions are always adjusted to the situation, you actually have less problems suppressing your feelings or shaping them in a way that they fit the situation. And in fact, your feelings follow the behavior more than if you think that emotions are authentic, that they come from within and that they need expression. So this Freudian idea of catharsis or the emotion idea, like emotions inside that need to come out and that need to be expressed. So in cultures where the idea is that emotions are inside and need to come out, it's harder for people to adjust their emotions to the circumstances than it is for people who think about emotions to begin with as created by the circumstances. So we do find real differences. And so one of the examples, we have lab experiments that show that, but we also have research in the real world. And for example, Chinese service workers who need to be happy do not suffer from burnout when they need to do emotion labor. We find that service workers in the United States and probably Europe do suffer from negative consequences when they try to moderate their feelings and have them meet the expectations of the environment. So it also has some real, how you think about those emotions also shapes some of the processes that we're interested in. So this is one of them. The other is, of course, if you think about emotions as going on between people, what we saw in the face experiment, then of course, if you're asked to say what this middle person is feeling, you look at what all the people in the situation are feeling because it's something that goes on between people. And so that's what we see, that emotion perception, emotion regulation, feelings, consequences of emotions can be and are affected by whether your culture emphasizes or you emphasize more of a mind model of emotions or more of an hours model of emotions. I'm making it more complicated for your sophisticated audience, but I wouldn't say there are mind emotions and there are hours emotions, but I would say that cultures differ substantially in what the dominant emphasis is on these models.
Yeah, and I'm really glad that you elaborated a bit more on that, because one of the things that I found myself wondering, and I'm sure that you've received this question before too, and I know before we started recording, we were chatting a little bit about different research approaches or traditions, and we started talking about like the cognitive behavioral approach or tradition, is whether these emotions that are experienced as different across different cultures are different in their internal experience, or whether the situations that are being responded to, or maybe the appraisals of situations that are being responded to, are what is causing these differences. So that was something I'd been curious about. And so I'm glad you elaborated a bit more.
So what is the difference between the, you know, if you have different appraisals, if you, for example, have the appraisal that, you know, what just happened to me, I may not like, but it's not so important compared to what is needed in this situation. Of course, that's a different appraisal. Or, you know, I may have been a little bit offended, but this is an elderly person and I need to have respect. I mean, at the moment you start perceiving the world with this different perspective on top, your appraisal changes. So, and of course, your emotion changes. And appraisal theorists, in principle, think that there are, you know, as many emotions as there are configurations of appraisals, right? So I don't think that two perspectives really are mutually exclusive. I think if you take appraisals theory seriously and say they're just different ways in which the world can appear to you, you know, in which, another way of saying it is, in which you make meaning of the world. There is another aspect that I haven't touched, but, you know, I think appraisal theorists are a little bit individualistic in that the assumption is that individuals at every moment, again, by themselves, appraise what this situation means to them. Now, that, I think, is underestimating the role of environment, where a lot of situations just have meaning or get meaning from the fact that everybody around you gives them meaning. So I think it's given the individual a little too much influence. There is a shared reality. You cannot completely make up your own reality. In fact, I would say that we live our lives through shared realities. But still, even if the meaning largely comes from how we make it together or how it has been made before even you came, just what it means in your culture to experience something like this, it's still the meaning that an individual and their environment give to an event that would determine how you feel, right? And their nuances, there are many variations in those appraisals, however they come to be.
Mm. And since we've gotten ourselves onto the subject of meaning, something else that you also spend a little bit of time addressing in your book is also about how we communicate these meanings with each other, and also about the role of language in how we experience emotions. And I know you touched on this a little bit just now when we were talking about the facial experiments, that these words that they were being matched to in some ways were inherently already altered in some way because of how they were translated, maybe. I was wondering if you could speak a bit more to the role of language in emotions.
Yeah, it's a really big question, of course, but I did touch on it a little bit. I don't think we're talking about language. I think the reason language has been out of focus for so long is that many emotion psychologists did think of emotions as those essences that didn't change. And so if everybody comes with the same however many emotions, then the matter of labels is a peripheral matter, right? It's, you know, however your language expresses it. And I think it's a little more than that. I think what language does is categorizing the world that we live in. But there are two things that are variable there. One is the world that we live in. So what kinds of emotional experiences we have from the start of our lives to, you know, and in our cultures. And the other is how the categorization of those events happens and what is foregrounded. And there's always this question, of course, there's even my advisor Nico Freire wrote about it, that if you choose a different word, what you choose is a different, is to highlight different characteristics of the situation. So you can call this more or less the same situation a situation of anger or of sadness. And so what you highlight in one case is what you highlight in both is that what happens is not desirable. What you highlight when you say you're angry is your entitlement and possibly some of your power to change the situation. You can say that by labeling it angry, you make the situation so, right? It's not just describing what is already there. You highlight something that can be highlighted, but in doing it, you're also making meaning. So that's one part. I think that language is used often to play the part. You know, if I play the part of being of entitlement, then I'm calling on this category that invokes my entitlement. I cannot always do that, by the way. Your context and your position determines whether you do that and other people will accept it. Because sometimes, you know, a child can be angry, or, you know, in former times, a woman could be angry and it was inappropriate and people would just deny the claim. But so that's in part that words have an active role in creating the situations. Words also are categories of experiences, and they're categories of experiences that you have. So you literally, if you want to say it, you know, this is very similar to the idea of predictive coding. You literally draw on previous experiences and you see if they apply to a new experience. And in a way, what you do when you use a label is to say, what are all the instances that, you know, that happened there, and can I find an instance that looks like it? Words or concepts also have all the possibility of finishing the episode. So you can say words also have scripts, right? If in the beginning of an episode you say, oh, it's like this situation, it also tells you it tells you to predict what other people are going to do. It also tells you how you might respond, or what the most proper response, or the most, what do you call it, the most suitable response is. So in that way, it feeds you experience from before, and it directs you towards what you can do. And words, of course, are not just charged with individual experiences, but they also, in the book I say, they have a repertoire of cultural stories. That's a little simplified, of course, but there are some meanings attached to words that are probably cultural and that you see around you. If your culture thinks of anger as, I mean, basically, not maybe a desirable emotion, but basically an okay emotion to have in a relationship, then it becomes a very different emotion than if your culture thinks that anger is disruptive and inappropriate and childish, which, you know, there or the biggest sin there is, like in some forms of Buddhism, it's considered to be. So the culture also fills, you know, gives the label or the concept a lot of connotations that then color your experience.
So I'm hearing a lot of the fact that it will go both ways, that for a lot of these ideas.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Mm. It will go both ways. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And language is, I think, a tool to organize experiences, both past experiences and future experiences. And it's also a tool, and that's not unimportant, it's a tool in which we communicate experiences with each other, right? We, in a culture, language is a tool of, is is a, a huge way in which we share experiences without really sharing them. Because I cannot look into your head, but I share, or to the extent that I share language practices with you, you know, it's as if I were sharing your experiences. Mm-hmm. We can fool each other. I don't know that we really, but we can fool each other.
Yeah, and we were also talking about how emotions come from these episodes, or are made up from these different experiences that we have that inform us whether an emotion fits or is suitable, like you were saying, for a certain context. And a lot of that is based on our past experiences. And I'm wondering how the discrepancies in how different cultures might experience or treat key emotions influence children as they grow up, and also just development as well.
I was going to say, when you said they people shape our past experience, of course, people also co-shape experiences, right? And in childhood, that's very clear. That's because children don't have emotions. I mean, they have feelings, but they don't have emotions. So what parents teach them in different ways is real. It's very clear that the parents are involved in experiencing the emotions. So what do parents do? I think they highlight what events are worth having emotions about. So they say, you know, they highlight, and in the book I describe how I would praise my son a lot for really irrelevant things, but you know, the idea of feeling proud about yourself was really focal in my child rearing. But of course, there are many cultures in which that is not the case, where it's much more important for a child to experience when they're falling short of the norms, or when they're disobedient, or when they're for a child to be calm, for example, not excited. So we teach our children different experiences to single out and pause at. What we also teach our children is, exactly what we categorize their experiences. So we say, you're angry, or she is angry, we basically say, this is the category, this is what you should look at. And what we also do, which is really powerful, is we respond or don't respond as caregivers. So, you know, there is this work by Heidi Keller, a developmental psychologist who looks at infants and their caregivers, mostly mothers. And she shows that even really early on, you know, some mothers respond to when the baby whimpers even, and some mothers don't. But they also want their baby to be calm. And so they're nursing their babies. They're doing everything to make their babies calm, but they're certainly not eliciting their baby's feelings. They're also not particularly responding other than making the baby calm again when their babies make noise. You know, similarly with somewhat older kids, there are cultures where people completely ignore the anger of their children because it's inappropriate, it's childish, and they shouldn't. There are cultures where people give in to their angry children, thinking that they're still immature and that it will come. And there are cultures where people are taking their children in a way very seriously and either say, you know, either respond to them, not just calming them or giving in, but just saying, taking it seriously as a claim to change, or become angry themselves, the mothers, which means also, you know, taking it up against your children's will. So it's very different responses that ultimately shape how kids learn to do their emotions. And what we see is that these differences can almost always be explained by what kind of child do they really want. So the mothers who nurse their children and who respond to every first whimper, they want their children to be calm, because a calm child is a child that you don't have to pay attention to, and you can work alongside this child. The mothers who give attention to their children's anger or protest are the mothers who then think that children's will and their own initiative and what they think about the world is really important. So they want a child that's in control of the world, that takes that is empowered, that takes initiative. So what we see is that these different ways of responding, it's not that the caregivers would be able necessarily to articulate what their goal is, but what we can see is that emotion socialization almost always is a way to cultivate a child that fits into a cultural ideal or that can function. Another way of saying it is to you socialize your child's emotions so that they can function in their social world as a social, as an emotionally competent person.
Mm-hmm. And then as they go on to experience these emotions, they're then also additionally shaped by, of course, that initial parenting context and yes, that feedback that they receive. And then it goes on to depend more on maybe the interaction, the particular relationship they find themselves in, or the culture that in which that emotion is taking place. And I am really curious to hear more about your thoughts on how these differences in emotional experience interact with a certain culture's values. So one of, whether this is positive emotions or negative emotions, one of the examples that stood out to me in the book is how you were talking about how this American notion of happiness is very unique to America and to the United States, and how maybe some other cultures, more negative emotions such as shame might be seen as this idea that you are being humble, or that you know your place, or that it is a sign that you have to change something about your image. So I'm wondering how, yeah, these emotional experiences shape what a certain culture values or places emphasis on.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's bidirectional, right? Mm. So it's there are different ways of answering your question. One is to say what, you know, a good person can be a person who is happy. And I think, you know, America or middle-class white America, I mean, we shouldn't overgeneralize there either. But happiness, or the excited kind of happiness, is what makes you a good person. And why that is, because a happy person has a lot of initiative and knows what they want, and they're not too dependent on others. Whereas a good person can also be a person who fits right into the environment. And of course, being aware where you fall short and being able to correct that, you know, is of great value there. And it's not that in those cultures, I wouldn't say in those cultures, being humble is a great experience, or being ashamed is a great experience. Far from it. But a good child in those cultures is a child that knows shame. It's not a child that is shameless, is really a problem in those cultures. So now the other thing that you may have been referring to is that even, I mean, I don't think that anybody would say that shame is the ultimately good feeling, but shame is a feeling that is useful if you want to be a good person. But there are also differences in what people find the most, what the emotions are that they strive for. And, you know, what is a good emotion? Even how would you prefer to feel? And that's, you know, a lot of the work by my colleague Jeannie Tsai has been about that, which is, you know, what is your ideal emotion? And she finds that whereas European Americans want to be excited, happy, that most Asian Americans want to be Asian Americans and East Asian people in East Asia want to be more calm. And so even if you talk about what feels good, what feels good is different. So there are two things, what you strive for and what feels good. And what feels good, even what feels good, is different. So you can, and I don't think only between, probably not only between cultures in the sense of national identities or ethnic groups. I even think that my 20-year-old self was more focused on having excited happiness than my 60-year-old self is. And so you can see how, you know, what you strive for is really different. Do you want to have new things? Do you want to be in control, or do you want to, you know, make sure that your relationships are stable, that you can accommodate. So there too, you can link the ideal emotions to values that people have or tasks that people give themselves. But it's a slightly different way of looking at cultural differences. Nobody would say shame is what they really want to feel, but they would say shame is what you need to be a good person. But people would say that calm is really not calm or not being excited, but just feeling good is the right emotion to have, is the emotion that they would strive for. And in fact, when Jeannie Tsai and her colleagues showed, I think, Taiwanese children a face of a very big smile, with a very big smile and a sort of a modest, calm smile, and she said, "What is most happy?" The Taiwanese kids said that, I think they said that they were both equally happy, but the European American kids said that the big smiley face was more happy. So there are really differences in the idea of what is a good emotion too, what it is that you would like to feel if you had all the choice in the world and you were in charge of what you were feeling. So even there, we differ.
Mm-hmm. And so we spent some time now talking about how these differences might come to be. And a lot of our conversation has talked about the bi-directionality of these different ideas. And I'm wondering, for, you know, the world is increasingly becoming much, much more multicultural, people of all sorts of different backgrounds coming together. And I'm wondering about, for all of us who are interacting with one another, we might begin to now have this awareness, especially after reading your book, that we all experience emotions a little bit differently. Maybe that depends on our past experiences, our cultures that we've lived in. And I'm wondering how we can interact with one another, and how we can attend to another person's context so that we can better understand their emotions. Is that, or if that is the goal or not even. So I'm wondering about your thoughts on that.
Yeah, my thoughts on that are exactly what you say, is that we can be curious about each other's context, on what is important for each other and what the context looks like, what the emotions might mean. And that in that way, I think I call it resonating, but you can resonate with somebody's feelings without really having them. So I can think, you know, I can try to understand what it means to be ashamed in that context, and why Taiwanese parents would want their children to be ashamed, or even what it might feel like to be ashamed in that context, without ever wanting to raise my child that way, but just understanding it. So I think, you know, my thoughts about it are more and more that we need to be humble, that we can't just infer from, you know, for the researchers' audience that you talk to, that we can't just infer from one context how emotions work for all the other contexts, that we need to, and I will say I haven't always done that in my career, but that we need to take our data really seriously, that if people say, you know, they see in that person, they don't see sadness, but they see a person who might be about to cry, that we don't say, oh, that's basically saying sadness, but that we take those data seriously. And in daily life, I think it really is trying to be humble about your own knowledge about another culture, trying to find out what is at stake for other people, what they're feeling without presuming it, what it means, what that means for their behavior, what they think, what they anticipate the consequences will be. So I'm in my book, I'm making, because that's what every trade book publisher wants you to do, is to give your readers a tool. Now, of course, you know, I haven't tested that tool. I'm giving that tool at the end of my book. I am actually doing research now to see if, because that's really what I suggest, is that if you know the junctures of cultural differences in emotions, that you could probe for those differences and try to understand where people from another. So if I know that emotions come about for different reasons, there are different things at stake in different cultures, then maybe that helps me. I'm just trying to see how it helped me to understand emotions from different cultures. I think it helps me understand emotions from different cultures if I know that the values, the kinds of things that you asked about, the values are different, what it means to be a good person in that culture is different, how emotions need to be expressed is different, the language is different. So I'm just looking at the kind of junctures of cultural difference and see if in this new study, if you tell people about those differences, if they have more way of communicating about them. But that's really a grant that we just got and are trying to test. Mm-hmm. It's what anthropologists describe they do. Is they, the word resonating that I use comes from anthropologists, where they say, how you understand the emotions of people from other cultures is not by empathy. It's not that I try to imagine what I feel if I were in your place. First of all, I may never be in your place. And also, I may not have the same emotions as you have with your history and your cultural environment and your knowledge and your goals. But if I understand that history, that perspective, that culture, maybe I can approximate how you're feeling and what you think, how you think you have to behave or respond to it. So I think that should be the goal. And I think we need to be much more modest about what we know based on our own experiences.
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought that up, because one of the passages in the book that really stood out to me was about, I think it was probably in one of the later chapters when you wrote a little bit about empathy and how you drew this distinction between, like, there's a difference between saying or thinking that you're empathizing with a person if you're taking their perspective, but imagining how you would feel in that situation. That's not quite the same as being able to understand or empathize with how that person would be feeling given all their past experiences, that specific context, that there's a bit of a distinction.
Absolutely. Yeah. Also empathy, there was an analysis of how empathy is used in emotion review issue. And that was a really clear classification. I mean, some people use empathy to mean exactly what I mean, which is a cognitive empathy. You try to understand what the circumstances are. But some people use the word empathy as really trying to project your feelings. And I think that kind of empathy is not helpful. And so, you know, my conclusion is that it would be better to ban the word empathy, because it also means things that I think we should not pursue. But there are forms of getting closer to people and paying attention to them that I think are helpful in understanding their perspective and the way that they might relate to the situation they're in.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for your time, Bachchan. Before we leave off, I do have one final question for you that we like to ask all of our guests on the podcast, and you referenced it briefly just now when you were talking about your new studies and this new grant that you have. But I'm curious if you could tell us a little bit more about what you are working on now or next.
Yes. I'm working at, I would say, three topics. One is what happens when people from different cultures meet. So can we change? Under what circumstances do we change? Do we need to change our emotions? What happens to immigrants or bi or multiculturals? Do we have, you know, different emotion repertoires for different situations? All of these things are things that I'm interested in a big, there's a European research grant in which I and my colleagues are working on the topic of what we call emotional acculturation. But what we mean by it is really what happens when you get, when people from different cultures get exposed to each other. The other research topic is a little more modest, is what I told you, is when you tell people what we know about where emotions differ, does it help them to understand each other? And does an interaction go more smoothly if people know where to probe? That's really another small project, but it's a project nevertheless that we embarked on. And then there is another project where we look at we take very seriously in that project that we do emotions together with interaction partners, and we look at couples and mothers and their teenage daughters in different cultures. And what we really look at is when they are in emotional situations, how do they respond to each other emotionally, and how do the two partners together shape the emotional interaction, or another way of saying it, shape the emotional episode. So we really look very seriously at our proposition that emotions are never done in a vacuum, but always with other people. And then we look at how they're done with other people, how they're done differently with other people in different cultures. So there we compare Belgium and Japan at the moment. But those are sort of the three directions in which my research is going at this particular moment in time.
That sounds like so much going on at once, research-wise. I'm really excited to read more and learn more about that work as it is completed. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me and our audience today. Again, the book is Between Us by Dr. Bacha Mesquita. And thank you so much once again.
Thank you, Jolie. Actually, my website is bachamesquita.com.
Okay, great. So all of our audience can go visit there as well. Okay. Perfect. Thank you.
Bye-bye.